All right, so we're talking about your new cookbook called Buck Buck Moose. And I have to confess, I have never had a cookbook like this on my shelf, but now I'm a little bit obsessed. Can you talk about what one can expect to find in this full-on tutorial?
Well, it's kind of, I suppose the short way to put it would be, it is everything you ever wanted to know about deer and deer-like animals like elk and moose and antelope and that sort of stuff from a global perspective as well as from a nose-to-tail perspective. So it's the sum total of not only my knowledge of working with these animals, but also those of many, many experts that I interviewed to make this book. So we kind of wanted to make it, basically call it a category killer in the publishing industry of like it's that book for deer. You won't need another one.
Okay, great. All right, now you've been tackling the hunter-gatherer side of the culinary arts for a while. You have another book, a website, a podcast. Can you talk about your nothing-packaged approach to food and
sure.
and maybe what you've seen kind of in this lifestyle over the years?
It is interesting because it has changed over the years. I have been foraging and fishing my whole life, and I picked up hunting about 16 years ago or so.
Okay.
And I started the website almost 10 years ago. And the difference, even since I started the website in 2007 to now, is pretty profound. When I started, there were way more people who would come up to me and give me a hard time for what I do. And I call these the cellophane people. You know, if you're a vegetarian or you're a vegan, that's great. You've thought about your food choices and you've made one. What I used to get all the time were regular folks, you know, people who would buy meat at a supermarket and then would call me a monster because I go out and get it myself. So the fascinating thing, and I view it as really positive, is that I don't really get that anymore. I get lots of people saying, oh, yeah, that's a good way to get your meat, especially if, you know, because you can avoid factory farms and all the horrors that are in some of those farms. And so I think people that I, you know, not just people that I meet, but I think Americans in general are starting to get it, that this is a legitimate way to go about feeding yourself and your family.
Great. And do you find that you appreciate the protein a little more too, taking ownership over it instead of just kind of like ripping open chicken and throwing it down your throat like nothing?
Oh, it's a lot more, not a little more. I mean, it's profound. I mean, it's just the book goes through it because, I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted the book to be so nose to tail. I mean, there's recipes for pretty much every part of the deer in there, and it's because, you know, it's the old, if you broke it, you bought it, right? And something died that you can eat. And that's kind of heavy, you know? I mean, it's not, so I never call it sport hunting because, you know, sports are like football or baseball or whatever. Hunting is too serious for that. So I call it a pursuit.
Okay.
And when you put an animal on the ground, it's not something to be taken lightly. And so it's extremely important to use as much of that animal as is possible. And so where I come in is I want to provide and give people the ammunition and the information to use things like hearts and livers and tongues and shanks and neck meat and all that sort of stuff in a way that's not only as accessible but also is very, very tasty so that it doesn't become something that they feel obligated to eat. It becomes something that they actually look forward to every time they go out in the field.
And now right off the bat in the cookbook, you say that, quote, deer make us human. What do you mean by that?
It's fascinating. I mean, so, you know, when I started doing the research for this, I happen to have I read as much about human anthropology as I possibly can. You know, I studied it in college, and I try to keep up with all the latest research, and there's a huge body of evidence that suggests that, because, you know, nobody really knows because we weren't there, but that suggests that for the past million to million and a half years, many of the adaptations that make us us were spurred on by pursuing deer-like animals. For example, we're extremely good at running things down. You know, not like a cheetah, but we're extremely good at just persistently running after something until it gets exhausted, then we can dispatch it. I mean, we've been doing this. It's called persistent hunting. And the only reason we can do that is because we have an arch in our foot, and no other primate has an arch in their foot. We're the only primate that can throw worth a damn. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen a chimpanzee throw, but they're not very good at it.
I haven't. Where,
yeah, I mean, they can huck things, but they're no good at really actually, you know, not like a baseball pitcher or a javelin thrower.
Right.
And throwing, I mean, what were we throwing at? We were throwing spears and things at deer-like animals. Our ability to communicate is profoundly deeper than the abilities of anything else that we know of. I mean, the dolphins might be able to talk the way we do, but we're not sure. But there are lots and lots of animals, for example, that can say, hey, there's a tiger over there. You should watch out. But no other animal that we know of can say, hey, you know, the other day when you were down by the creek picking berries, there were tigers on the other side of the creek, so you should watch out when you go there tomorrow. That kind of detailed spatial and time-oriented descriptions, that's how we, they think, coordinated, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 of us to go and run down something like a mammoth or a, you know, an Irish elk or some of these great big animals that we've been chasing since before we were fully us. So there's, I mean, to put it, you know, in a nutshell, there's a lot of physically and mentally what make us us has been at least spurred on by the pursuit of big game animals. And so there's a cultural weight to deer hunting that does not exist with, say, you know, pheasant hunting.
That's fascinating. Very cool. Now, you touched on this a little bit before, but I'd love to go back to it because the cookbook really does include a ton of tips and techniques for breaking down the whole animal. And whole animal butchery is something that has had a bit of a renaissance lately. We have whole animal restaurants here in D.C. where you know the chef, when they order the animal, they are using every part of it. Why do you think that we're seeing this? Why do you think we're seeing this trend lately?
I think, and this is just my observations, I think there is a increased desire to not only know where your food is coming from, but to eat ethically. And pigs and deer and chickens and whatever, they're not all breast meat. They're not all chops. They're not all tenderloins. So more people are aware that, you know, a pig or a deer or something like that has other parts to it too. And so there's a desire to be, food has to think good as well as taste good. And the knowledge that you are doing your bit as a diner by ordering, say, shanks or, you know, I don't know, crispy fried pigtails, which, by the way, are awesome, or to eat deer neck and taco meat or something, there is an increasing awareness that that's one little thing that you can do to combat, you know, food waste and to promote farmers or people who are obtaining their food in an ethical way. Because if you're trying to support a little, you know, small farmer who raises hogs or something, going nose to tail is the only way that actually works is from an economic standpoint.
Okay, great. And now there are recipes in this book. You turn the meat and all of the parts into everything from barbacoa to pierogies to Greek dolmas, curried meatballs. It seems like a deer seems like a pretty versatile meat.
It is. You know, it's not uncommon. I mean, if you're listening to this and you don't have access to venison, the two things that will get you closest in terms of flavor would be bison or grass-fed beef. Kid goat might be reasonably close. Lamb is pretty close in size, but it tastes like lamb. It doesn't taste like venison.
Right.
So a lot of the recipes that you might use beef or lamb or goat or something like that, you can either adapt them for venison or the other way around. So the cool thing that I found doing the research for this that really kind of shocked me is not only is there such an ancient history of us with these animals, but it's global. So there are people all over the world, more or less every culture all over the world, has at least a history of chasing something like a deer. So, for example, there's a kebab recipe, the ground meat kebabs in the book, that I got this recipe from my banker, a guy named Omar, who, you know, when I told him that I need, you know, just doing some financial things for the book, and he said, oh, you know, I really miss hunting gazelles in the eastern deserts of Lebanon. And it just kind of blew me away, you know? Who knew that they still hunted gazelles in the eastern deserts of Lebanon, even today? And this was one of his recipes. So the global nature of it, it not only shows off the versatility that you're talking about, but it also shows off that there is a connection, a global connection to the enjoyment of these animals that really is kind of nice and interesting to look at. I mean, even, you know, I know some of the people listening out there are going to think, well, what about the Australians? Well, I don't know if you've ever eaten kangaroo, but it's damn close to venison.
Huh. I haven't.
It looks just like it.
Huh. Very interesting. And do you have a favorite recipe in here that you like to use often?
You know, I mean, it's like trying to pick your best children.
Right.
Your best child. You know, one thing I do a lot, I mean, I happen to be on a Mexican kick these days.
Okay.
So I do a lot of Mexican food. So I make a lot of tacos and mole and that sort of stuff. And the baseline recipe in the book for barbacoa, which can be done with shanks or with neck meat or with shoulder, and these are all pieces of the deer that a lot of people just grind. And when they do this recipe, and then it can be a jumping off point, because once you have the shredded braised meat, you can put a mole on it, or you can just put it in a taco or whatever. That's a recipe I use all the time as a jumping off point for whatever Mexican dish I'm exploring at the moment. And it's very easy to do as well.
Very cool. Now I have to ask about your background, because I read that, well, I know you're a former restaurant cook, but before that you were a political newspaper reporter. How did you go from politics to hunting?
There's all kinds of snarky things I could say.
I know.
About that.
I was afraid how to set that up, right?
So the hunting itself, it's kind of a different, you know, there's two ways to answer that. One, I picked up hunting when I was an investigative reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and they didn't really have anything to do with each other. My best friend at the paper was the outdoor writer, and he just took me under his wing and effectively created a monster. But if you're asking about the writing and the cooking, because I was a restaurant cook, and then I was a reporter, and then now I'm sort of whatever it is that I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, I mean, the reason I got into politics and in covering politics is because I was fascinated by the idea of people of different points of view coming together in one building, you know, the U.S. Capitol or a state capitol. Richmond was the capital I covered the most.
Oh, that's where I'm from.
But I was in Congress too, mm-hmm. So I've walked those halls as well. And what was fascinating about it was to watch people from all these different backgrounds come together to solve a problem, like the farm bill or the transportation bill. Well, as you well know, if you live in this town, that compromise and debate has kind of broken down over the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes people who choose to not do any sort of compromise or debate in any meaningful way, and they just sort of yell past each other. Now, as a journalist, that becomes inherently boring. Nothing actually happens. It's just people shouting, and that's dull, because it becomes infantile.
Mm-hmm.
So, yet I still had to make a living, so politics became something I was good at, but I no longer loved it. So I went back to where I had been and started writing about food. And, you know, I mean, there is a precedent for this. There's the great New York Times reporter, a guy named Johnny Apple. And Johnny Apple did the same thing. He was, I believe he even covered the White House, but he was a big-time New York Times political writer in the 60s. And then he switched over and became one of their best food writers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of trying to model myself as the poor man's Johnny Apple.
Well, I feel like food writing these days also is very political. There are so many political topics within food itself. So kind of full
it
circle.
It can be, but I choose to stay away from those.
Yeah.
I've done my time. You can pretty much suss out what my politics are by what I do and what I say. But I'm not Barry Estabrook. I don't want to jump into the actual politics of food. It just... I guess after 18 years of covering actual politics, I'm tired, and I just want to show people what you can do with game and fish and forage stuff. And if that's political, then so be it. Having just spent a lot of time in the D.C. region, I think one of the things that I saw, and I was really happy to see it, were a lot of young urban professionals either returning to hunting, and both men and women. You know, maybe they had gone as a middle schooler or something like that, or taking it up for the first time. And I think that's a really great thing to see out there, that there's a new blood or a whole new bunch of people getting into this pursuit. And the fact that there's bajillions of deer in your area, as I've saw in Rock Creek Park and other places,
yes,
it makes it something that not only can they explore, but they can have a reasonable idea of being successful, which is kind of cool.